A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's prompt this week starts with a flight itinerary that sounds like a dare. Tel Aviv to Dubai, 14 hours with a 14-month-old, then Dubai to Boston, then a drive west into Connecticut. He did that because the direct New York fares were so absurd that flying east to fly west actually made financial sense. His question to us isn't just whether that number is real, but who on earth pays it? Why they don't just buy the plane, and whether this whole market is growing because first class keeps getting worse.
The number is real. That's the thing I want to say up front, because I think Daniel half suspected the AI was hallucinating a luxury fantasy. It wasn't. A one-way transatlantic heavy jet charter with positioning cost lands right in that range.
His question is whether that estimate was realistic, who actually charters instead of owning, and whether the market is growing as commercial first class gets worse.
So we priced it out, and the answer is more interesting than just a number. The number checks out, and what it reveals about private aviation is strange. The plane Daniel got quoted is a machine that costs its owner money every single hour it sits on the ground, and the quote reflects the industry's attempt to make that machine's idle time somebody else's problem.
What's the actual size of this thing?
The global business jet charter market runs roughly $28 to $30 billion a year, growing 5 to 7% annually. That's not a niche. The workhorse for this route would be something like a Gulfstream G65ER, which has a range of about 7,500 nautical miles. That's around 8,600 statute miles, so it can make Tel Aviv to Hartford without refueling.
So the question underneath Daniel's question is whether this is a status symbol, a transportation mode, or an asset class in disguise.
And I think the answer is all three at once, which is why the pricing looks insane from the outside and rational from the inside.
Before we ask who pays this and why, let's actually take the quote apart. Because the price isn't one thing, it's five things stacked on top of each other.
So when you charter one for a 10 or 11 hour flight, you're paying for all of that, compressed into a single invoice. Think Gulfstream G550, Bombardier Global 6000, something with the range to do it nonstop, and the cabin to carry a family plus crew, plus baggage across the Atlantic.
And the hourly rate on those machines?
Then you've got landing fees at Bradley International, then catering, which on a private jet isn't peanuts and pretzels, then insurance, which for a $70 million aircraft is substantial. That's the floor, not the ceiling.
But the quote was 150 to 200. Where's the rest?
That positioning flight costs money and burns hours on the airframe. That cost gets baked into the quote. To pick him up in Tel Aviv, the operator has to fly the aircraft empty to Israel first. That ferry leg can add $30,000 to $50,000 to the total before Daniel ever steps aboard.
So he's paying for a flight he never sees.
Hartford is further west than New York, so you're pushing toward the upper end of that band. Daniel's quote was at the low end. After dropping Daniel off, the jet either deadheads back to its home base or repositions to wherever the next paying job is. Another empty leg, another chunk of cost.
What does fuel run on a crossing like that?
It's a different product entirely. The crew is positioning, flying 10 hours, overnighting, possibly laying over for the return, landing and handling fees at both airports, international overflight and navigation charges. Insurance, and then the operator's margin on top of all of it.
So the line items are ferry, fuel, crew, fees, margin. Five things.
It lands at the airport closest to where you're actually going. You skip the terminal entirely. Positioning flights, return legs after a drop-off, repositioning between jobs. That's 40% of all flight hours generating zero revenue.
And Daniel's quote is expensive precisely because his trip is a one-way with no guaranteed return.
If there were a paying customer in Hartford who wanted to go to Tel Aviv the next day, the operator could split those positioning costs across two charters and the price would drop. But there isn't, so Daniel eats the entire inefficiency.
How does that compare to just flying first class?
25 to 40% of the full charter price, sometimes less. So the charter is 3 to 5 times the cost of first class, not 20 times. That ratio surprised me when I ran it.
3 to 5 times is still a lot of money.
It is. But what does the premium buy? No connections, no security lines, departure on your schedule, the ability to bring a 14-month-old without the airport gauntlet. You land at Bradley, walk off the plane, get in a car. And that's the thing that makes the market so strange from the outside. The sticker price is real, but almost nobody smart pays it. The brokers who know the empty leg schedules can cut costs dramatically.
So the number checks out. But who actually writes that check?
Not the people who own jets. That's the counterintuitive part. The charter market isn't for the jet-owning class. It's for what the industry calls the occasional ultra-high-net-worth flyer.
What about the middle ground Daniel didn't ask about, but is actually where a lot of this market lives?
Fractional ownership. NetJets, FlexJet. You buy a share of an aircraft, typically 1/16 to 1/2, and you get guaranteed flight hours per year. The ownership math kills the just-buy-it instinct. A G65ER costs $70 million to buy. Then you've got $2 to $4 million a year in fixed costs, crew salaries, hangar fees, insurance, maintenance. And the asset depreciates. A jet isn't the house.
So you own a piece of the plane, but none of the headache.
You own a slice of availability. The operator handles crew, maintenance, hangar, positioning. You just book hours. It's the bridge between full ownership and per-trip charter, and it's where a lot of the actual demand sits.
What does a fractional share cost?
For a super midsize, you're looking at a few million to buy the share, then six figures a year in management fees, then maybe $5,000 to $8,000 per occupied hour. It's not cheap. The tax angle matters too. Chartering for business purposes is often deductible as a business expense. Owning a jet triggers luxury asset taxes, depreciation recapture, and increasingly, political scrutiny.
That political angle is interesting. Trump has been going after private jet usage in his fight with Carney, framing it as a symbol of elite excess. The asset class is becoming politically radioactive.
Which is a real shift. Private jets used to be a status symbol that nobody questioned. Now they're a talking point in political fights. That changes the calculus for people who might otherwise buy. And here's the thing. You pay that whether you fly 50 hours or 500.
So the fixed costs are enormous, and the marginal cost of one more hour is relatively small.
That's the structure. Fuel and direct operating costs scale with hours. But depreciation, hangar, insurance, the crew's base salaries, those are fixed. You're paying them even when the plane sits.
Which means there's a break-even point.
Around 200 to 300 flight hours per year. Below that, chartering is cheaper. Above it, ownership starts to make sense. And here's the kicker. Most private jet owners fly 100 to 200 hours annually, meaning most owners would be financially better off chartering.
So, the rational economic actor would charter, and the actual owner is buying something else.
Convenience. Guaranteed availability. The ability to customize the cabin. The plane is ready when they want it, where they want it, configured how they like it. That's not a financial decision. Daniel's trip is the perfect illustration. He spent 14 hours on a plane to Dubai, then another 12 or so to Boston, then drove. A charter would have cut that journey nearly in half, and he'd have landed 40 minutes from his in-laws.
But at $150,000, the time savings cost about $10,000 an hour.
Which is the honest way to think about it. Is your time worth $10,000 an hour? For most people, no. For a CEO closing a deal, maybe.
And that's the market. It's not about luxury. It's about the economics of time for people whose time is worth that much.
There's a misconception that chartering is only for people who could buy a jet. The reality is the opposite. The economics favor chartering for anyone flying fewer than 20 or 30 long-haul trips a year. Most charter customers couldn't justify ownership.
The misconception that the quoted price is the real price. Empty legs and broken negotiations can cut costs dramatically. The market punishes inflexibility, not just wealth.
The third misconception is that it's a status symbol. For the actual market, it's a time-saving business tool. The status symbol is the jet you own and park at Teterboro. The charter is just a faster way to get to a meeting. Law firms, medical practices, small business owners who need to be in three cities in one day and can't do it on commercial routing.
So, the industry is splitting into two tiers.
And the tiers have different customers, different pricing logic, different aircraft. The heavy jet transatlantic charter is a $100,000 product. The light jet regional hop is a $5,000 product. That's the dream. The reality is that empty legs are still coordinated by brokers on phone calls. The technology exists, but the industry resists transparency because opacity is profitable.
Daniel's $150,000 quote is real, but it's also a fiction. It's the price you pay if you're inflexible and uninformed. The real market is stranger and more negotiable.
The economics are one thing, but the actual experience of booking one of these flights is another world entirely.
This is where Hilbert has been waiting to say something.
A CEO needs to visit three manufacturing sites in 2 days. The commercial schedule has her overnighting in hubs and missing meetings. That's a fair correction.
It's a productivity tool.
It's a productivity tool with leather seats. The second segment is high net worth individuals for specific trips. Family vacations, medical emergencies, events where time is the constraint rather than money. And the third is organizations that need group travel on fixed schedules. Sports teams, film crews, political delegations.
A basketball team charters because flying commercial with 7-foot players through O'Hare is a logistical nightmare.
And because the schedule is fixed by the league, not by the airline. If the game ends at 10:30 and the next one is in another city the following night, the charter is the only way to make that work.
So Daniel's question about why not just own? The answer is that the charter market is built on the economics of an asset class. The planes exist because someone bought them. The charter market rents those planes out when the owner isn't using them.
And here's the structural irony. The owner is often better off chartering. The charter customer is often better off not owning. The whole market exists because the asset is too expensive to sit idle, and idle is what it does 40% of the time.
The empty leg market was a phone tree.
First class has degraded. Lie flat seats are narrower. Lounges are more crowded. That's the thing that hasn't changed. The technology improved, but the information asymmetry is structural.
But the charter market's growth is less about discomfort and more about time.
Time efficiency and schedule control. The ability to depart from a small airport 15 minutes after arriving, skip security entirely, and land at a regional field near your destination. That's the value proposition. Comfort is secondary.
Daniel had a 14-month-old. He wasn't flexible.
And for a corporate traveler doing 50 trips a year, that's 300 to 400 hours saved annually. At executive compensation rates, the charter pays for itself before you even factor in the comfort.
So the market is growing because time is getting more expensive and commercial air travel is getting slower.
Slower and more friction-heavy. Security lines, connection times, schedule padding. Commercial aviation has optimized for cost per seat mile, and the cost of that optimization is passenger time. Charter has optimized for time, and the cost of that optimization is money.
Which brings us to the knock-on effect. The growth of light jets is creating a new tier of service that undercuts the heavy jet market.
That reframes the whole thing. The product isn't transportation, it's scheduling.
What's driving that?
The aircraft themselves. The Citation Mustang and Phenom 100 are cheaper to operate than their predecessors. Single pilot certified, efficient engines, lower maintenance costs. That drops the hourly rate to 3,000 to 5,000, which opens up a whole new customer base.
So the same structural logic that makes Daniel's court expensive is also making the lower end cheaper.
And the lower end is where the volume is. Thousands of regional charters for every transatlantic one. The heavy jet charters get the attention because the price tags are absurd. But the light jet market is where the industry is actually growing.
The opacity you're describing is still the core of the business.
200 to 300 hours a year. Below that, charter. Above that, own.
And most owners fly 100 to 200 hours.
Which means most owners are below their own break-even. They'd save money chartering, but they own anyway.
What Daniel got from the AI was the subsidized price, not the real price.
Because ownership isn't a financial decision for them. It's a control decision. The plane is available on zero notice. It's configured exactly how they want it. The crew knows their preferences. That's the honest answer. The quote was accurate. It just wasn't the whole market.
So the asset is a convenience purchase.
A convenience purchase that happens to look like an investment. And that's why the charter market exists. The owners fly 150 hours a year, which means the plane sits idle for the other 8,000 plus hours. The charter market monetizes that idle time.
And the owner recovers some of their fixed costs.
If they put the plane in a charter program, yes. Many owners do. They hand the aircraft to a management company. The management company charters it out when the owner isn't using it, and the owner gets a revenue share. It doesn't cover the full cost of ownership, but it takes the sting out.
So the charter customer is subsidizing the owner's convenience.
That's the clearest way to put it. The surge pricing is built into the structure.
And the empty leg problem is the tax on the whole system.
40% of flight hours generating zero revenue. That's the industry's dirty secret. Every empty leg is a cost that has to be absorbed somewhere. Either the charter customer pays it in positioning fees, or the owner eats it in operating costs, or the broker discounts it to fill the seat.
Discounted empty legs. That's a thing?
But the industry will resist that because the opacity is the profit margin. The flight goes when the plane goes, not when you want to go.
So there's a shadow market for cheap private flights.
There's a shadow market for cheap private flights that requires you to be ready to fly to wherever the plane happens to be going on short notice. It's not a product for planners. It's a product for people who can drop everything and go.
That sounds like a fascinating subculture.
It is, and it's where the industry's inefficiency becomes visible. The empty leg is the market's way of saying the asset is underutilized. The discount is the market's attempt to fix that underutilization on the fly.
What happens to the empty leg market when demand drops?
The discounts get deeper. During the 2008 financial crisis, empty leg prices collapsed. Brokers were selling transatlantic empty legs for $5,000. The planes were flying anyway, repositioning, and any revenue was better than none.
So the charter market is more volatile than it looks.
It tracks corporate profits and executive confidence. When companies cut travel budgets, charter demand drops first. The planes don't stop flying, they just fly emptier. The empty leg percentage goes up, and the discount market gets flooded.
Which means the price Daniel got quoted is partly a function of the current demand environment.
Partly. The base rate for a heavy jet transatlantic charter is always going to be six figures. But the positioning fees and the margin fluctuate with demand. In a hot market, the operator can charge full freight for the ferry leg. In a cold market, they might absorb some of it.
So the quote is real, but it's not fixed.
It's a market price, like anything else. The AI gave Daniel a range because the range reflects the uncertainty in positioning costs, fuel prices, and demand at the time of booking.
Let's talk about the fleet itself. Who owns the planes that get chartered?
A mix. Some are owned by charter operators directly. Some are owned by individuals and placed in management programs. Some are owned by fractional companies like NetJets and sold in shares. The fleet is fragmented.
The brokers sit on top of that fragmentation?
The brokers are the market makers. They have relationships with operators. They know which planes are available where, and they match customers to aircraft. They take a cut for the match.
That sounds like a market ripe for disintermediation.
It's been trying to disintermediate for 20 years. The problem is the asset is too expensive and too mobile. A broker who knows that a specific G550 is sitting in Geneva and needs to reposition to New York next Tuesday has information that a customer can't easily get. The broker's value is that information.
The inefficiency is the product.
The inefficiency is the product. The broker sells access to the empty leg, the repositioning flight, the idle asset. The customer pays for the broker's knowledge of where the planes are and where they're going.
That's why the industry hasn't been Amazoned.
Amazon works when the inventory is standardized and warehoused. A private jet is neither. Every aircraft is different, every position is different, every trip is different. The broker's knowledge is the inventory.
What about the big players? NetJets, VistaJet?
They're trying to standardize the product. NetJets with fractional ownership, VistaJet with a subscription model. They own or control the fleet, they guarantee availability, they set the prices. They're trying to turn charter into a product rather than a negotiation.
Does that work?
For the corporate market, yes. A company wants predictable pricing and guaranteed availability. They'll pay a premium for that predictability. The fragmented broker market can't offer it.
The industry is consolidating around a few dominant players at the top, while the lower end stays fragmented.
That's the trajectory. NetJets and VistaJet own the high end. The light jet market is still fragmented, with regional operators and brokers. The middle is getting squeezed.
Which connects back to Daniel's question about growth. The market is growing, but it's growing unevenly.
The corporate segment is growing steadily. The light jet segment is growing fast. The ultra-long-haul charter segment is growing slowly because the customer base is small and the price is high.
The first-class degradation is a tailwind, not the main driver.
It's a tailwind. The main driver is time efficiency. First-class getting worse just makes the comparison more favorable for charter.
What would make the charter market really take off?
A step change reduction in operating costs. Electric or hybrid aircraft, autonomous flight, something that drops the hourly rate by half. That would expand the market dramatically.
Is that realistic?
The light jet segment is already seeing some of that. Newer aircraft are more efficient. But the big leap, electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft for regional hops, is still a few years from commercial viability. When it arrives, it could reshape the entire lower end.
The industry is in a holding pattern, waiting for the technology to catch up to the demand.
The demand is there. The technology is the constraint. The cost structure is the constraint. The empty leg problem is the constraint.
Let's circle back to Daniel's original question for a second. Was the AI estimate realistic?
Yes. 150 to 200,000 for a one-way Tel Aviv to Hartford heavy jet charter is consistent with market rates. The AI wasn't hallucinating. It was quoting the real cost of a real service.
The fact that it's real tells us something about the market.
It tells us the market isn't about luxury. It's about time. The price is the cost of time for people who value it at $10,000 an hour or more.
The fact that most owners fly below their break-even tells us something about ownership.
It tells us that ownership is a control purchase, not a financial one. The charter market exists because the asset is too expensive to sit idle, and idle is what it does 40% of the time.
You keep saying empty leg like it's an inefficiency. I sold empty legs for a living. It's not an inefficiency. It's the whole game.
Say more.
Late 90s? I worked for a charter brokerage in White Plains. Aero Vista Charter Services. The owner was a man named Sal. He had a Citation II that spent more time repositioning than carrying passengers. My job was cold calling Fortune 500 companies and selling the empty legs at half off. The real money was never the flights. It was the deadhead arbitrage.
Deadhead arbitrage.
The jet is flying empty anyway. Any paying passenger is pure margin. I sold a New York to Palm Beach empty leg for $4,000. Fuel cost was $2,500. That's 60% margin on a flight that would have been 100% loss. That was the business. Not luxury. Arbitrage.
The broker's job was to find someone, anyone, to sit in the empty seat.
Any seat, any direction, any price above fuel. Sal didn't care where the plane went. He cared that it didn't fly empty. I had a list of companies that could drop everything and fly. Law firms, hedge funds, a couple of entertainment people. I'd call them at 9 in the morning and say, plane's going to Palm Beach at $2,000-$4,000. Sometimes they said yes.
What was the markup on the normal charters?
15% to 20% for making a phone call. The dirty secret is half the charter flights were flown by jets owned by the broker's cousin or friend. The broker takes a cut for knowing the plane exists and knowing the customer needs to fly. That's the whole job.
The industry runs on information asymmetry.
It runs on who you know and who owes you a favor. Sal knew every operator at Westchester County Airport. He knew which planes were sitting, which owners were behind on payments, which crews were available. That knowledge was the inventory.
What happened to Sal?
The Citation got repossessed. He was behind on the lease. The last empty leg he ever flew was from White Plains to a bankruptcy auction in Delaware. The plane sold for less than the cost of the fuel he'd put in it that morning.
That's the whole industry in one image.
The owners are renting their own jets from the bank. Half the people selling charters don't own the plane. The customer thinks they're buying luxury. They're buying access to a depreciating asset that someone else is desperate to keep flying.
That story about Sal and the repossession, it underscores the point we were making about ownership. The owner isn't necessarily wealthy. The owner is leveraged.
Sal was leveraged to his eyeballs. The Citation was financed. The hangar was leased. The crew was contract. He owned nothing except the phone number of every Fortune 500 travel manager in the tri-state area.
When the music stopped, the asset went to the bank and the knowledge walked away.
The knowledge walked away with me. I still have the list. Well, I have a list. Most of those companies have their own flight departments now, or they use NetJets. The world moved on.
The world moved on, but the structure didn't. The empty leg is still 40% of flight hours. The brokers still take 15 to 20%. The owners still fly below their break-even.
The planes got bigger. The money got bigger. The game didn't change.
The next time I'm on a 14-hour flight with a 14-month-old, somewhere above me there's a Gulfstream flying empty, and someone is paying $150,000 to make sure it isn't.
That's the structural irony. The charter market exists because of empty legs. The price Daniel got quoted is partly the cost of the industry's own inefficiency.
The question that stays with me is where this goes. Light jets are democratizing the lower end. Commercial first class keeps degrading. Does the mid-market bifurcate further, or does the industry consolidate around a few dominant players who own the fleet and the pricing power?
I think both. The high-end consolidates around NetJets and VistaJet. The low-end fragments into thousands of regional operators. The middle gets hollowed out. It's the same pattern as every other asset-heavy service industry.
The empty leg problem doesn't get solved. It gets managed.
It gets managed by better software, better matching, better pricing. But the underlying physics don't change. A plane that drops you in Hartford has to go somewhere next. If there's no paying customer there, it flies empty.
That's the thing I'll remember from this. The price of a private jet charter isn't the price of luxury. It's the price of a machine that refuses to sit still.
The market exists because there are people who will pay to make sure it doesn't.
We should thank Daniel for the prompt. It started as a curiosity about an AI quote and turned into a tour of how an entire industry prices time.
Thanks to Hilbert for producing and for the reminder that every empty leg has a broker somewhere trying to fill it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a question that sends us down a rabbit hole, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.